For Public Radio News, it's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Until recently, Alzheimer's disease could only be diagnosed after the fact. In other words, when patients died and their brains could be autopsied. But now there are new methods to detect Alzheimer's while the patient's still alive: blood tests, genetic tests of spinal fluid, and most recently, brain scans. But deciding to be tested is a huge deal, given that there's no cure for Alzheimer's, no certain way to slow its progressive taking away of memories and basic abilities like eating or talking. Still, scientists encourage people to consider testing. They believe early detection could mean better treatment and even cure. Thus far, most experimental therapies have been given to people well advanced in the disease, and the results have been disappointing. But researchers say outcomes could be different on middle-aged people whose brains show signs of Alzheimer's but who don't yet have any symptoms. This hope has major implications. As the population ages, the number of Alzheimer's patients is expected to double from 5 million today to 10 million in the next few decades. And that trend may show itself earlier here in New Hampshire, since we're one of the nation's oldest states. Today in The Exchange, an Alzheimer's update, and let's hear from you. Have you cared for someone with this disease, or have you been diagnosed with it yourself? What has your own experience taught you about its impact on families, individuals, society? And what questions do you have about some of the very latest research? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. With us in studio is Meg Curtis, Alzheimer's advocate and widow of Skip Curtis, who passed away at age 62 from Alzheimer's. Meg also facilitates a support group in Bedford. And Meg, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us, Dr. Robert Santulli, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Dartmouth, Director of the Dartmouth Memory Clinic, and Director of Geriatric Psychiatry at the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's author of the new book called The Alzheimer's Family, Helping Caregivers Cope. And Dr. Santulli, welcome, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from Boston, Dr. Robert Stern, Director of Boston University's Alzheimer's Center's Disease Clinical Core and Professor of Neurology and Neurosurgery. And Dr. Robert Stern, thank you also for your time.
Thanks very much, Laura.
Well, and Dr. Stern, I want to turn to you first, actually. Why is it that most of the progress, it seems, has been made in terms of detecting Alzheimer's instead of progress in treatment and cure and prevention?
Boy, that's a tough question. Alzheimer's is such a complex disease. It is so complex. There's no one reason for it starting in the first place. We don't really know how it starts in the first place. We know a lot of the basics of what's going on in the brain, but trying to actually intervene to stop the whole process from moving forward has been an incredible stymie for the neuroscientists around the world. We're getting so much closer, though, in terms of being able to develop great new compounds that can modify the disease. But what we've been able to succeed in a little easier is the ability to detect the disease while someone's alive.
Yeah, and we'll get into in just a minute whether people want to know that they have a predilection for Alzheimer's disease. But, you know, this week on Monday, just the National Institutes of Health announced four major new studies aimed at treatment, two looking at drugs, one on exercise, and one for a drug for treating agitation, which is a chronic problem with many Alzheimer's patients. Again, Dr. Stern, what do you think? What are some of the possibilities with this new NIH grant and this new NIH research?
Yeah, so what this is a consortium of centers around the country called the Alzheimer's Disease Cooperative Study. We here at the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center are part of it. I've been sitting on the committee for this group for a long time, and it's real exciting that the National Institutes of Health continue to support our efforts to try new and exciting approaches to treating this disease. And these aren't industry-sponsored or pharmaceutical company-sponsored treatments. These are treatments that us scientists are putting together. And so each of the four new studies are really exciting. One in particular, called the A4 study, is going to hopefully change a lot about what we know regarding treatment of the disease, because we're going to be trying a variety of new compounds early in the disease course before people have symptoms.
Yeah, Dr. Santulli, pretty excited about this?
Yes, it certainly does look very positive, very promising in contrast to the treatments we have now, which are a little bit too late in the game. So clearly the effort needs to be treating people before they show any signs of the disease. That's one of the reasons why early diagnosis is exciting, so it'll tell us who needs that treatment. The diagnosis of the disease prior to having symptoms, and certainly those developments have been happening quickly, as you alluded to earlier. Hopefully, some of these treatments, such as in the A4 treatment and some other A4 study, and in some other ones that are similar, will lead us to the right kind of medicines for the disease. But it's become very clear that if we wait until people are symptomatic, whatever damage has been done is not going to be undone by any medication.
So that's the argument for, again, early diagnosis,
yes,
early detection.
Yes, absolutely.
How do you feel, though, about the question, Dr. Santulli? You know, given that there's no cure, given that this disease is pretty devastating, I mean, losing your memories and your ability to even do basic tasks, how do you explain to people who may feel like, look, I don't want to know. I don't want this hanging over my head.
Well, I don't disagree with them at the present time because we don't yet know how to treat people who may be in for this disease but don't have it yet. If we had the treatment for that, we'd all want to know. But right now, the only thing that knowledge would give you is gray hair and worry about every time you forgot where you put your car keys,
right,
the disease is starting. And that's not going to do anyone any good. There are people who want to know, but we strongly discourage people from getting any testing at the present time, unless they're in one of these clinical trials that Dr. Stern alluded to. We strongly discourage anybody because the information doesn't give you anything to do except worry.
Wow.
And Laura, if I could add something just for the viewers so they have some basic understanding of what we're talking about here, that when people currently talk about getting Alzheimer's disease, what they're really referring to out there in the public, and maybe when you see your primary care physician, they're referring to being diagnosed with dementia. And what dementia is just the clinical manifestation of a variety of diseases where it means you have some memory problems, other cognitive difficulties that are severe enough to get in the way of daily life. And that's what dementia is. It's kind of like having a fever. If you have a fever, it tells you, you know, you're sick, but it doesn't say what's causing it. And so dementia is kind of the end stage of a long process of many different diseases. The most common disease that leads to dementia is Alzheimer's disease.
That's a question that often comes up. What's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Exactly. And so Alzheimer's is the disease that leads to dementia. Dementia is just a clinical syndrome that is not a disease or an illness in itself.
Meg, I want to bring you into this, given your personal experience. What are your thoughts around this idea about, you know, early detection? Do you want to know? Given that there's no treatment, what do you think, given your personal experience? Your husband, as we said, you know, passed away at a pretty early age from Alzheimer's, age 62.
Right. I have to agree with Dr. Santulli that it does nothing but give gray hairs if you know about it. My husband did have the APOE4 gene. Therefore, you may or you may not end up with Alzheimer's disease. Would I like my three children tested? Not really. Not really, because it causes too much stress.
How did you know that your husband had that gene? What prompted him to get tested for that gene?
Well, we were involved with studies at Boston University with Dr. Stern. And I would highly recommend that anyone being diagnosed with Alzheimer's take part in these studies. It's so, so important that we have people that want to contribute. So I would highly recommend that anyone, it's never too far to go.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear more about your story in just a minute, but also invite our listeners to join us. Big topic today on The Exchange, and a tough one, too. We're looking at some of the research and developments around Alzheimer's disease. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's take a call from Wilton. Ruth is on the air. Hi, Ruth. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. I am in favor of knowing this if I have that gene for two reasons. First of all, if I know about it, I can be available for potential treatment. And even not knowing if it'll work, it's some kind of light that I might want to chase. And the second one is that if I become highly disabled, highly demented, what about the possibility of assisted suicide?
That's a tough one, Ruth. And another place where I thought she was going to go, Meg, was, if you know you have a chance that you might get this disease, you could do some at least long-term financial planning, given that the financial costs of Alzheimer's are high. But what do you think about her statement that she would want to know to be available for treatment, to be involved in some of those studies that you mentioned?
Absolutely. I agree that to be available for the studies is number one priority.
What was it that made you decide to be involved in those studies? Was your husband showing signs that made you think, ooh?
No, he had just been diagnosed, and I immediately, being proactive, said, we have to do something now, even if it's studies. You never know. We might get lucky.
Yeah.
We might be one of the lucky ones. And that gives you hope, and that is what keeps you going through the whole process, that hope that something someday may happen, and maybe you will be the recipient.
Right. Maybe you're that first person
Yes.
who shows
and if not,
signs.
If not, you're helping the next generation.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Ruth. I don't know, Dr. Santulli, if you want to jump in on her other comment, assisted suicide. It's very depressing to get this diagnosis.
It certainly is, and this is an issue that comes up increasingly, I would say, and will come up even more when we are able to diagnose more people as being on the way to Alzheimer's, but not showing signs yet.
All right.
So it's a big question to discuss.
Well, Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us. And we'll take a lot more of your calls and emails after a short break. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll be back in a minute.
Good morning, 919, and more of our Alzheimer's update on The Exchange coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We take a look at federal and state efforts to reduce gun violence. New Hampshire weather, we have a winter weather advisory in effect for much of the state through today. Cloudy with snow accumulations will be lightest in northern part of the state, where 1 to 3 inches may fall. 2 to 6 inches for south central and southern New Hampshire, with a little less on the seacoast as it mixes with some rain. Parts of central New Hampshire and the western Connecticut River Valley will see about 2 to 4 inches. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Unity Homes from Bensonwood, designed to improve the world by enhancing quality of life and reducing energy consumption. Information at unityhomes.com. And Holly Oil, offering automatic delivery, 24-hour burner service, and now delivering bioheat to customers throughout Manchester and Concord. Holly Oil, HALLEOIL.com. Alzheimer's reporting on NHPR made possible with support from Roof F and Harlow Dow Savage Foundation. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the latest developments in Alzheimer's disease. And we invite your questions and comments about this. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. If you have personal experience with this disease, what has your experience taught you about its impact on individuals, on families, on society? Also, if you have some questions about some of the latest research that we've been talking about in terms of diagnosis and the hope for treatment and cure, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Dr. Stern, I want to go back to some of this latest research that we touched on earlier in the hour. Used to be, as I said, the only way you could definitively tell someone had Alzheimer's disease was after they died and do an autopsy on the brain. How do you detect it now, Alzheimer's now, before the patient is gone?
So what's great is this brand new set of developments that we refer to as biomarkers. And biomarkers are these objective biological tests that are specific to the disease that we're trying to detect. And there are a variety of these types of biomarkers available right now for research purposes for Alzheimer's disease, including things like spinal fluid assessment. So you have a lumbar puncture or spinal tap, and that spinal fluid can be tested for the proteins that we know are have gone awry in Alzheimer's disease, the beta amyloid protein and the tau protein. And by looking at the specific measures of those proteins, we have a signature that is consistent with Alzheimer's disease. Another way is through a special kind of PET scan, where a specific type of chemical that attaches to that beta amyloid protein gets into the brain and is temporarily radioactive, and you go inside a PET scanner, and it shows you now where and how much that amyloid is in the brain. These are real exciting things, because in the past we had to wait for someone to pass away
right.
and look at their brains after they die. Now we can detect these changes in these proteins while someone's alive.
Yeah, and you know, the old-fashioned way too, I'm guessing, Meg, of detecting Alzheimer's, besides these latest techniques that Dr. Stern's talking about, is just behavior, right? I mean, what did you notice with your husband that made you or him think, oh, he might have Alzheimer's?
Well, one of the things, he used to have a list of 25 things to do in a day, and he'd usually get 30 done. But
wow.
all of a sudden, he started wandering just aimlessly around the backyard, just looking around. He'd have some things he wanted to get done, and he couldn't get one task finished. But I just thought perhaps he was depressed. I think that's a very easy thing to pass it off as depression. However, I found out the hard way. I got hit right in the face. Financially, when I came home one day and he said, we're going to lose our home.
What? Wow.
And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, I guess we're going to lose the house. And I said, well, how could we do that? You've paid the mortgage every month. Well, I said, you did pay it, didn't you? And he said, I don't remember.
Oh,
and it
dear.
Was at that second, I knew that I had a problem. And the other reason that it would jump into my head is my sister-in-law did pass away from early onset, and my mother-in-law passed away from Alzheimer's disease also.
So he had this in his family.
Yes, he did.
And the changes you noticed, Meg, were more than just, you know, me walking to the pantry this morning and going, why did I walk
yes.
to the pantry?
He'd been losing his car keys for years, but you don't necessarily tag someone as going to be having Alzheimer's just because they can't find their car keys. It happens to me all the time.
Right. You know, before we go back to our listeners, lots of calls and emails coming in. Dr. Santulli, talk a little bit more, please, about this link to depression that Meg mentions.
Well, it's very common to see people who have both cognitive problems, early cognitive problems, and depression. And depression can make cognition worse and vice versa. So whenever we see someone in the clinic, we want to be very alert for whether or not when they're coming in complaining about memory, whether or not depression is an important part of it or significant part of it. We can treat that, and we need to treat that, and some of those individuals then appear not to have such severe cognitive problems, but some do, but they're still less depressed. So it's a very important link. There have been some studies that have suggested that depression, repeated depression over the course of one's life, may be a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. There has been some looking at whether or not depression occurring around the time of the development of Alzheimer's might be a cause of the disease, but most of the research now would suggest it's merely an early symptom of Alzheimer's.
Let's go back to our listeners. And again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org. Waiting in White River Junction, Vermont is Paul. Hi, Paul. You're on the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. Something that really bothers me, and this has to do with the general approach of our scientific and medical community, is we're always trying to hit on some sort of cure before we even ask this question, what factors in the environment may be causing spikes in all the illnesses that are becoming prominent in this day and age? Now, I'd sort of like to ask two questions. Number one, how long has Alzheimer's been around? Has it been around for 10 years, 30, 60? Do we know how common it was 50 years ago? And if it wasn't common, why is it common now, number one?
I would say because people are probably living longer, right, Paul? Don't you think that has
something to do with it? Well, you know, the gentleman who you talked about who was 62 was a young man. I'm 76, okay? But anyway, that's a question. Number two, what about environmental factors? I mean, there's so many changes that have taken place in our food production system and our system of growing. Are people looking into whether factors in the growing process or the processing of food process are maybe a factor in the cause of a problem like Alzheimer's?
Yeah, Paul, it's a great question, and thank you. And I know people are looking at that in terms of other diseases for sure. What do you think, Dr. Stern? The easy question first, how long have we been talking about Alzheimer's? And then the harder question, are people looking at environmental factors, chemicals used in food processing, chemicals in the environment or whatever?
Yeah, Paul, I'm so glad you brought those things up. To answer the easy question, Dr. Alzheimer first discovered this disease in the early 1900s, in around 1905. And it was not until that point that we had a real understanding of what it looked like inside the brain and what the behaviors were. And so we've been studying it in greater detail for the last 20, 30, 40 years. So the question is, why are we seeing more of it now? And one easy answer is that, yes, indeed, we are living longer. The greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is living longer, is age. That doesn't mean that it's a normal part of aging. There's something wrong when someone does develop this disease. But we have to remember that we as human beings weren't really meant to live past the age of around 40. And so now that medical science has allowed us to live much longer, we're seeing a whole variety of diseases that would never have been seen if we hadn't lived this long, diseases of aging. And so Alzheimer's disease is one of these diseases that we are seeing more and more as we're getting older. But like Paul brings up, we are seeing it in younger people, like Skip Curtis, perhaps in their 50s. Well, part of that is also surveillance. We now talk about it more. We now know how to diagnose it better while people are alive. People are not just hiding in the closet with it or thinking that it's a bad thing and we can't talk about it. And so we're able now to say, you know what, this person's change in functioning and cognitive skills is likely due to Alzheimer's disease, so we're seeing more of it. But to get to that issue of environmental exposure and what kinds of things in the environment might be causing Alzheimer's, unfortunately, with a lot of research into it, we haven't seen anything that does have an impact on developing the disease out there in the environment. It's not things like the type of things in the air or neurotoxic kind of exposure. We do know that eating well and exercising well seems to put off the dementia from Alzheimer's disease, but it isn't necessarily the causal factor. Eating these bad things or having poor and kind of intake of food or poor exercise, those things don't cause it, but they might be playing some kind of role.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul, for those questions. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Calling in from Harrison, Maine is Debbie. Hi, Debbie, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for this topic. It's definitely needed for people to know about it and discuss it.
Go ahead, Debbie.
I'm calling about early diagnosis and the fact that it's not just elderly. My husband showed symptoms in his 40s.
Wow, that's young, huh?
It was a nightmare getting a diagnosis. It took first misdiagnosis. We were told it was just stress and attention deficit. And because of that misdiagnosis, we then did not get our disability insurance because they considered it a pre-existing condition. We ended up going to Mass General and the University of California Memory Center in San Francisco before we actually had a diagnosis. And as an early, as a caregiver, it's a nightmare. Financially, emotionally, still working, had a child in high school, now in college at the time, it destroys the whole family.
Wow, yeah, financially, emotionally. So is your husband still alive, Debbie, may I ask?
Yes, he is. He is physically healthy. He can still hike mountains, but you have to have somebody with him because he might do something totally unpredictable.
Right.
And paying for someone to come in every day is horrible. Not knowing the future, you know, how long he's going to be able to take I have no idea. I just live day by day, trying to take care of whatever little strange things happen during the day. And the disease is so unpredictable. Like right now, I've got the knobs off the stove because he, even though he's promised to only use the microwave, he will go back and decide to cook a cheese sandwich and leave the oven on. It's just, you know, constantly like that.
Gee, so it must be hard for you to go to work.
It's terrible. It's you know, I go to work not knowing, and it's also terrible coming home because, to be honest, coming home is just starts a nightmare all over again. He has strange things where he thinks people are coming in to steal his clothing, the mail, the whole nine yards. So it's like having two full-time jobs, and it's like living with a stranger, too.
Oh.
It's not the person I married, but I am his caregiver. And my parents and his parents are both in their 80s, and because we're younger, all our friends are working during the day, so our options are limited, and we don't qualify for anything. He's too young, or I make too much money, or because I'm in a rural area, there are no options.
Well, Debbie, thank you for calling, and what a struggle. And I've got somebody up on the line now who may have a couple thoughts and maybe even answers about your struggles. So thanks for calling in. We really appreciate it. Susan Ankoviak is with us. She's Vice President of Regional Officers for the Alzheimer's Association, Massachusetts and New Hampshire chapter. Now, you're calling from Maine, Debbie, but I'm sure there's a chapter that deals with Maine. Susan Ankoviak, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, good morning, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Well, and we just heard that heartbreaking story from Debbie with such an early diagnosis for her husband and her daily struggles. How does the Alzheimer's Association help someone in that situation?
Well, I feel fortunate that I have an opportunity to come on right after Debbie's comments, because her story certainly is a very real and complicated story. And that is one of the many family scenarios that we try to work with the Alzheimer's Association. And, you know, essentially, Laura, we have two main missions to our work. One is certainly advancing research so that we can better understand the causes of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. We certainly need more treatment options available to families right now. And ultimately, we need to eliminate the disease altogether. But another very, very important part of our work is working with families such as the situation described. Probably the most important thing that I hope your listeners will know is that the Alzheimer's Association is available to families 24 hours a day, our helpline. If I may share that number, that's 1-800-272-3900. And what that number is able to do is to sort of open the portal, if you will, to some programs and services that we offer, including what we call care consultation. So that's an opportunity for us to really drill down with the family about their very unique circumstances and help to problem solve around some of these very real problems.
Okay, 272-3900, you said. And I did want to ask you about New Hampshire. I know you are with the Massachusetts and New Hampshire chapter, but specific help that the association provides here in New Hampshire, Susan, given that we've got rural areas where, you know, you may have to drive half an hour to get services, and sometimes it snows, the roads are bad. Are there specific services targeted to people in rural populations?
Actually, yes. We're very excited to be partnering with a couple of organizations. So the National Alzheimer's Project Act is a federal law that was created to really address this healthcare epidemic that we're dealing with right now. And through that law, funding has been made available to help. One of that is for us in New Hampshire to help reach out to rural communities in particular. So we started a pilot project last summer, which we will be continuing on in a robust way, to actually present video conferencing that will reach families and individuals living with the disease, as well as professionals, all throughout the state of New Hampshire. So we are in the process of working with various hospitals and other locations who have video technology that are closer to where many of these families live, and hope that it is another tool for them to be able to go to a hospital setting, for example, in their local community on a consistent basis to receive some very real education. It's all in live time. It allows us to interact with one another, answer questions, and hopefully give them some significant tools.
Well, Susan, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Susan Ankoviak, again, Vice President of Regional Offices for the Alzheimer's Association, Massachusetts and New Hampshire Chapter. And Debbie, our caller, if you're still listening, good luck to you, and thanks for calling in today. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Santulli, I'm so struck by Debbie's call and just how early this happened to her family and just how difficult it has been for her. You not only approach this from the professional end, but you also wrote a book, The Alzheimer's Family, Helping Caregivers Cope. What are some of the thoughts that you have about helping people like Debbie cope, especially? She said, he's too young to get assistance, and I make too much money to get assistance. It's tough.
This is one of the big problems in Alzheimer's disease. It's a very expensive illness for families.
Because you need 24 around-the-clock care,
in
basically.
In some cases, you do. And even if you don't need that, you need some assistance. And most insurances will not pay to have somebody come in. Some people have insurance that helps pay for medications, some don't. So it becomes very expensive even before people go into long-term care, into a nursing home, if that's where they end up. Thankfully, it's quite uncommon, but obviously not unheard of in occurring in people this young, but it's much less common than it is among the elderly. And I think one of the most important things, and I'm sure that the caller can certainly relate to this, as are many other people listening, is that one of the most important things for dealing with the disease is helping the caregiver cope.
Right.
And helping the caregiver manage his or her own stress, which is an enormous part of the illness. When the caregiver does well, the patient does well.
Yeah, if the caregiver is stressed out, he or she is not going to give good care. So it's all linked up.
Absolutely.
We will take more of your calls after a short break and your emails, so keep it right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and Southern New Hampshire's Montessori Academy, bringing educational choice for elementary students, individualized experiential learning in a multi-age setting. Details at snhma.org. And North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings, on time, on budget. Online at northbranch.net. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Talks from the legendary TED stage are coming to radio.
What TED celebrates is the gift of the human imagination.
Everything we think,
we've had to believe in impossible things.
Infinite possibility.
Big ideas that will change the way you look at the world. I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Saturdays at 1 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, NPR's counterterrorism reporter Dina Temple-Raston is with us on the security challenges President Obama will face in his second term. Email us your questions for Dina before the program at exchange@nhpr.org, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at some of the latest developments on the Alzheimer's front. We've been looking at this disease, hearing how it's affecting families and individuals here in the Granite State and around New England. The number for you to join us with your questions or comments is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, let's go right back to our callers. John joins us from Hillsborough. Hi, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Good morning, Meg.
Good morning.
I've known the Curtises for years and adore them both, and they've been patrons of my business. And when Meg and Skip walked into my pewter shop one day and announced that he had early onset Alzheimer's, I knew what they were facing because my dad had Alzheimer's. And just dovetailing on your comments before the break, I floated the idea of Skip coming and working with me. I couldn't really pay him much, but I knew that Meg was going to need help and she was going to need a break because taking care of an Alzheimer's patient is a full-time job and it can literally kill the caretaker. So it worked for a while. I adored Skip, had to reteach him a lot of things a lot of times, but he was just a joy to have around, and I was happy to be of some help because, you know, the old adage, it takes a village. Well, it really does with the case of Alzheimer's.
So, John, did you have a question or more just about reaching out to people dealing with this disease?
I think my comment just listening today is that people need to get involved and to help out, help the caregiver, because the caregiver, like Meg in her case, you know, was pretty much alone for a while. So, yeah, people just need to get involved and to pitch in and help because we're going to be seeing more and more of this, as you have alluded to earlier.
Right, yeah. Meg, go ahead.
I was just going to say I so greatly appreciated what John did because it gave Skip a reason to get up in the morning and a reason to go forward. He'd be so excited because he was going to the pewter shop to work. And he adored John as well, and our family just thanks him over and over for the opportunity that he gave Skip and the break that he gave me.
Right. As we said earlier, the caregiver needs a break. Real quick, Dr. Santulli?
I was just going to say that one of the hardest things is getting caregivers to take advantage of their friends. People really do want to help. It makes them feel better, and you certainly need it. If you ever need to rely on your neighbors and friends, it's in a situation like this.
Here's an email from Dave in Amherst, and I think I'll throw this to you, Dr. Stern. He says, just last week, my grandfather passed away from Alzheimer's, and my father is currently suffering from dementia. Dave says, at age 28, seems to me as though worrying is inevitable in these circumstances, regardless of whether or not one is able to find out whether or not they have the Alzheimer's gene. Dave says, what steps do you recommend to those that are already worried about the issue? Is there anything that one at my age can do to prevent the onset of dementia or Alzheimer's besides treatment? Dave, it's a great question. Dr. Stern.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And Dave's feelings are shared by so many whose family members are afflicted by this. The best advice is always keep yourself healthy, period. We know that the same things that are bad for your heart are bad for your brain. So do things like decrease the amount of the bad fats, increase the amount of the good fats, the omega-3 fatty acids, make sure that blood pressure is under control, make sure that diabetes is avoided or treated. Exercise has been found to be one of the most robust factors in preventing the onset of dementia. Keeping oneself constantly active intellectually, socially, these things seem to do things as well. But it's understandable that one is afraid. The reality is, very sadly, that around one out of two people, if they live long enough, will develop the dementia from Alzheimer's disease. Around one out of two people age 85 and older has dementia from Alzheimer's. And so we can't just live every day thinking, okay, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. We can do what we can to keep ourselves healthy. We can take advantage of appropriate treatments when they become available, or if one is inclined to take advantage of research studies and clinical trials that are available for people before they start showing symptoms, one can do that as well.
You know, it's been said, and this gets to what you said, Dr. Stern, about as people age, more and more of them will have Alzheimer's. It's been said, Dr. Santulli, that the graying of America means the bankrupting of America, partly because of Alzheimer's. Do you agree with that? That's a pretty dramatic statement.
If we aren't able to find a way to prevent it or cure it, it's hard to imagine it isn't going to bankrupt us. It's one of the most expensive long-term illnesses to deal with.
And why is that? We've touched on it, but...
Well, because the ultimate endpoint for a majority of people with Alzheimer's is nursing home care, which can be up to $100,000 a year. It's the largest, the cost of nursing home care is the largest item in most state Medicaid budgets, and everyone knows that those are under a lot of pressure right now, even with our current numbers. So as the numbers increase, I think our only hope is to try to find a way to prevent or to cure this illness, or else we're going to be in very dire straits.
We meaning especially from the healthcare perspective, the healthcare system,
and
Medicare, Medicaid.
Yes, and the economic system in general. The need to put those dollars into taking care of these individuals is growing.
All right.
I think we need to understand the perspective of this, that we spend every year around $200 billion to take care of people with Alzheimer's disease. That's a quarter of that infamous stimulus bill. And that number is expected to rise to over $1 trillion by 2050. And just in 2012 alone, we spent $140 billion on beneficiaries with Alzheimer's disease for Medicare. So the 25% of all Medicare payments are for Alzheimer's patients. So unless we do something now to redistribute that kind of money, to be able to put it now toward research so we can really reduce the numbers of people with this disease, we are going to see Medicare go bankrupt. We are going to see our economy go bust.
Did you say one quarter of Medicare payments are for Alzheimer's? Is that what you said?
That is what I said.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's huge.
I have another question for you again, Dr. Stern. This is from an email from Nadia. She says, beta amyloid, the protein present in the brains of Alzheimer's patients, is it a cause of Alzheimer's, or is it an effect slash consequence or a defense mechanism? Nadia says, it is crucial to clarify this question before designing medication, for instance, to destroy amyloid plaques. Nadia, thank you for that email. Dr. Stern, what do you think?
It's a brilliant question, and it causes a huge amount of controversy amongst the neuroscientists studying this. What we do know is that there's many different types of beta amyloid. And there are some forms of amyloid that are actually good, some forms that are not good. And there are, it's such a complex issue that to try to understand which one is good, which one's bad, and how to stop it has been the focus of so much research. And so what we think we know, at least the majority of scientists out there think, that beta amyloid, the bad form of it, when it starts clumping together and it's released around the brain, is the major initial cause of this cascade of events that occurs in the brain. And so the goal of so much research is to try to figure out ways to prevent that bad form of amyloid from being produced in the first place and to try to suck it out of the brain once it's developed. But that's not the only approach, because it's not the only thing that's gone awry in the brain. So there's this other protein called tau. When it goes awry, it wreaks havoc, and it's very much associated with the cognitive difficulties that one has. And so another approach needs to be to reduce the amount of this bad form of tau in the brain. And we need to do other things, too, depending on the stage of the disease. So the caller, the emailer is very insightful in questioning whether all of our efforts should be put toward trying to do something about beta amyloid. It's a very complex issue, and people are trying to come to deal with it on a daily basis.
Thanks, Nadia, for the email. And let's take another call. This is Kevin waiting in Concord. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a physician here in Concord, and I work in the hospital mostly, so I take care of a lot of old people, a lot of dementia. And I find that we're struggling to a large degree with the conversation about what to do with your parents who have this problem, who are in the nursing home, who have advanced dementia, who they're trying to take care of at home. And I get the sense that a lot of people just haven't had a lot of these good, important conversations about the realistic endpoints, what we're trying to accomplish, what your dad would want, what your mom would want. You meet this 50-some-year-old nice gentleman who's got an 80-year-old mother who's in a nursing home with demented. And he knows he wouldn't want that, but yet at the same time, he can't let her pass away, and she keeps coming back to the hospital with most of the complications of being severely demented and unable to take care of themselves. I was wondering what the panel might have to say about how we can help talk to families about this issue.
Yeah. Kevin, thank you very much for the call. Meg, that's for you, I think, first, and then perhaps Dr. Santulli.
That's what support groups are all about. And we don't have enough support groups. We need to educate everyone around us so that they can understand this disease and how to help and not feel guilty to put their loved one in a facility if that is their only choice. And I don't know what the answer is to more support groups. I'm available anytime for anyone that needs a support group facilitator, because families need this in order to survive. They need their questions answered, and they need not to feel guilty.
Dr. Santulli, you've helped set up support groups. You've written a book about families and so forth.
Yes, I think that Meg's absolutely right, that support groups are one of the most powerful tools in treating Alzheimer's disease that we have, and that's undervalued, underrecognized. And we need more groups, and we need to get people to come to support groups that do exist. But the other thing that I would comment about with regard to Kevin's question is the importance of having these discussions early on, establishing, if they aren't there in place already, advanced directives, durable powers of attorney for healthcare and finances. People need to not shy away from these discussions at any time in their lives, but certainly once a parent has developed some early signs of cognitive disorder, that's really when it has to happen if it hasn't happened before then. It's a job of the offspring to take the best care they can of their parents, doing what they would want. And the way to know that is to have gotten that information ahead of time through advanced directives.
Yeah, and we've talked about that on this program before. Easier said than done. And,
that's correct.
And once the disease is present, it's hard to go back. But yes, that's
right.
The hope. Mm-hmm. You know, on this same point that our caller raises and that you both raised, it's tricky, Dr. Santulli, I would imagine, you know, when you're dealing with a parent or a loved one who may have Alzheimer's. They're forgetting things. They're repeating things. They don't understand or remember that they just asked you 5 minutes ago, you know, where are we going tonight for dinner? You may have the same conversation in 1 hour, in the next hour. It's hard to not get frustrated and yell at the person, but you can't do that.
That's absolutely right. In fact, you said 1 hour or the next hour. It's 1 hour or five. It's one minute or 5 minutes later or 2 minutes later. The repetitive questions are really at the essence of the disease. And I like to say that about 90% of caregivers do at times get angry about that, and the other 10% just don't tell the truth.
So they don't. The patient doesn't really know he or she is sick and is wondering why is Robert getting mad at me.
Right. They don't understand that. And it would take the patience of Job to not at times feel some frustration. All caregivers know they shouldn't and feel very guilty when they do inevitably lose their patience with that. But it's just part of it. And it's the essence of the disease is to be repetitive. You don't remember that you've asked, or you don't remember what the answer was if you do remember that you asked.
And I want to let listeners know Meg is nodding her head, right? Meg, given your personal experience.
Oh, yes. I also think that speaking softly to the patient and using physical touch is so, so very important. There was a whole lot of hugging going on at our house all the time. Just the touch calms the person, and the soft voice calms them. They love music. There's so many things that should be integrated with the care of an Alzheimer's patient.
Dr. Stern, to you, we've touched on a lot of the research this hour, including, again, those new projects coming out of the National Institutes of Health just announced this week. What's the most promising research, do you think, Dr. Stern, on the horizon, not ready for prime time yet, but offering you some hope?
There's tremendous hope, and people have to understand that we are in such a better place now than we were even just 2 or 3 years ago. The combination of our improved ability to detect and diagnose the disease before symptoms, along with new medications and other interventions that can likely have a greater impact the earlier that we start it. And so there are some medications that are aimed at really trying to reduce the amount of that bad protein, that if we start it early, we likely can modify the disease course so people are not going to see many, if any, symptoms down the road. So I really do have a sense that in the next several years, we're going to be seeing treatments coming to market that will slow down the disease dramatically.
Slow down dramatically. So you gain an additional 5 normal years, 10 normal years?
Well, it depends. If we can really intervene earlier, before the symptoms start, and we can stop this process from wreaking havoc in the brain and eventually leading to the destruction of cells, then we might actually result in a relatively normal life.
Wow. Are you that optimistic, Dr. Santulli?
Eventually, yes. Whether it'll occur on that timetable or not, I hope Dr. Stern is right. I hope he is. I'm not sure. We've had an awful lot of false starts in the last decade, and it's been very frustrating trying to treat people with now medications that are more than 10 years old. So I hope he's right. And I think ultimately he'll be right. But when it's going to come, we'll have to see. People need to get into clinical trials, and a lot of money needs to be put into Alzheimer's research.
Yeah. Last thoughts from you, Meg.
I just want to say that just prior to my husband's death, he believed so much in research that I set up a fund for him at Boston University, and it's called the Skip Curtis Fund, and it is strictly for research for Alzheimer's disease. And I made a promise to my husband that if he passed away before they found a cure, that my voice would never be silenced until we found a cure for the monster Alzheimer's disease.
Well, Meg, thank you for sharing your story and that voice with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Meg Curtis, Alzheimer's advocate and widow Skip Curtis, who, as we heard, passed away at age 62 from Alzheimer's. Dr. Stern, good to have you too. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Robert Stern, director of Boston University's Alzheimer's Disease Center's Clinical Core, professor of neurology and neurosurgery. And Dr. Santulli, thanks for making the trip from the Hanover area. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Laura. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Robert Santulli, associate professor of psychiatry at Dartmouth, director of the Dartmouth Memory Clinic. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The views